Hello and welcome to the Managing Madrid podcast. This is Sunday evening. I'm your host, Kian Sobhani. Joining me is my good friend, managing editor of Managing Madrid, tactical dude on the site, Om Arvin. Om, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Kian, how are you doing?
Good. We're wishing our main man, Gabe Lesra, a splendid weekend off because it's his bachelor weekend. So enjoy it, brother. We love you very much. Wish we were with you, but we're with you in spirit. And just hope you can really detach yourself from work and everything and just have fun tonight. Om Arvind, things are back to utopia in Real Madrid world. Are you, must be over the moon.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm the same I was at the start of the season, cautiously optimistic, but that result against Leganés has everyone like just absolutely ecstatic. We know how it is with this fan base. It only takes one result to completely turn the mood, and I guess I'm not going to complain now because it's always good when we're all happy. I mean, I think all it takes, like, we're playing Athletic Bilbao next. That's going to be a tough game. Like, let's say we draw, which wouldn't be that surprising. The mood will completely change again. It'll be a disaster. We shouldn't have sold Ronaldo, blah, blah, blah. But for now, it's good. So I think we should all enjoy it, especially as writers, we should, because that means more positive comments on our articles. it's nice. I'm glad that at least there is some positivity, and I think some of it will last a little bit, because there was, I think, a lot of unjustified pessimism following this window, most probably before the Mariano signing, where we just didn't feel the club was moving in the right direction. That was a disaster of the window, with Kovacic leaving, not being able to replace Ronaldo in any capacity until Mariano came. But I think we realized that the sample size is small, but I think we realized that it's not a disaster, right? Like, this is still a fantastic club with really, really great players. And if we continue in the right path, we have a chance. It's not all over.
Yeah, we'll get to Mariano at some point during this podcast, because there's a lot of questions about him. The number and the signing, blah, blah, blah. I think it's interesting to look at the perspectives. One, a lot of people feel, okay, great, it looks good. The opponents matter. So just look at who you've been playing so far, Girona, Getafe, and Leganés. The counter argument to that is that, and as Phil Kittrell pointed this out on Twitter, we lost away to Girona last season and looked terribly uncomfortable and looked overrun. We couldn't deal with anything. Getafe...
I think the counter just for the Girona point is... Pablo Machin was the coach last time, but I think what Sergio Sacristán, the new coach, he's not a bad coach either. So, but I think that's an important distinction to make, because I think Machin is one of the best coaches in La Liga.
Correct. But also just take into the fact that something that is under talked about generally in La Liga is that La Liga, from top to bottom, every match in theory is difficult, right? Like, there's no
Getafe is underrated as hell. They were really good last season.
Yeah,
is not the same Getafe we've been used to.
No, they had a great defense last season, and actually against us they were decently organized. Like, our XGs were not that high in that game, if I remember correctly, but we had control, and that kind of will bring me to another point. But Leganés knocked us out of the Copa del Rey. Like, again, different coaches, sure, but you know, Manuel Pellegrino is no slouch, by the way. He's
one
coach, of the best defensive masterminds in the league. And that is also interesting, because I think there were a couple of things that I wasn't impressed with him doing in this game. But so that, I guess, is the counter, is that these are the games that you just need to win game in, game out, and put in the 3 points that you weren't doing last season, regardless of who was coaching and what the tactics were and stuff. Because to just do this consistently is what Barcelona have essentially been doing for years now, is these grinding out every game and you know, just making sure that every game is like a final. I think it's interesting, Om, is that, because we've talked in the past on this podcast about Real Madrid's ability to control games this season, and it's more about control rather than prolific chance curation and just kind of masking some defensive issues by just controlling the game. We talked about this to death. Again, you look at the XG in this game, it was 2.31 plus the two penalties. and it's good. I thought it was, I at no point did I really feel threatened in this game by Leganés, and I know that's harsh, but because they had the moment from when they scored the penalty until halftime, I'd say their defensive shape looked much better, and they actually started to kind of look okay on the counterattack. But from, I'd say before that and the start of this game, and Leganés didn't really press us from the get-go and let us have the ball, and especially from halftime into this 90th minute, it was just, and again, I've said this before, but Real Madrid, once you go behind against this particular Real Madrid, it's very difficult to claw your way back because they'll pass you to death, they will rack up possession, they will demoralize you, and they will just, and you just, they kind of smell blood, and more goals will come.
Yeah, I think in this game we had something like 77% possession. I
Yeah.
crazy. Like I can't remember ever having a figure like that ever like for the past like since I started watching Real
We
Madrid.
broke a record for passes. I don't know if you know that.
I mean that's insane.
Yeah.
Like just adds.
798 successful passes.
And I think yeah, like the possession statistics, that kind of stuff tends to get overemphasized like when you see it plastered on your TV when pundits are talking about it. Like, but I think it is important to discuss here at this moment because I think it represents a change in the style. And I think that relates also to Ronaldo leaving. Not that I think that we'd get less possession if Ronaldo was here. I think it's more, I think with Ronaldo gone, the fact that we control games is now more important because if you look, you know, again, small sample size, but our XG hasn't been out of this world. And even under Zidane, even when things weren't going well, when our finishing was terrible at the beginning of the season, we were still racking up huge amounts of chances every game, but the game was more chaotic and we would concede more chances to the opponents. And a large part of the reason why we relied on outscoring opponents was because Ronaldo was there. The guy is a prolific shot creator. You know, his ability to create for others decreased over time, but his ability to create shots for himself has stayed the same, whether that's with the ball at his feet or as we saw later in his career, off the ball movement. And we don't have that anymore. I mean, I think Bale, Benzema are very good in this aspect, but Ronaldo's the greatest of all time when it comes to that, no question in my mind. So that is a huge thing you're losing, and that means we're going to get a lot less shots per game. So when you are going to have less chances, and which probably also means less high quality chances, at least a couple of them, it's probably a better idea, or it suits you well to absolutely dominate the game and dominate the ball and be more patient and pick your moments for when you get a shot, because that limits the ability for your opponent to create while your shot numbers also decrease. So it kind of all balances out in the end. And I think, especially because I don't think the tactical philosophy and everything has been completely ironed out, which is to be expected. I don't even think 10 games in, it will really be completely ironed out. Having just being able to control games and being able to figure things out when we slow things down, that is extremely valuable. And that is why I think we've picked up the victories that we have so far.
Well, your point about Ronaldo's, I guess, shot volume is interesting because you do essentially lose that. And I think to me, again, it's about being more efficient. If you don't have someone prolific like Ronaldo anymore, and Lopetegui has talked about this in the past, is that you have to be better defensively and you have to make sure the chances you get are very good, and you have to be efficient when you take them. And by kind of securing the defensive scheme, then you may not need as many goals, as if, if your defense was kind of leaking goals, it's no longer a matter of just outscoring your opponent like Cleveland Cavaliers style. It's just a matter of actually zipping up and taking your chances. And until now, in the very small sample size we've outperformed our XG. We've literally averaged 3 million% possession. And I'd say apart from the first half in Girona, our defense has looked fine just by virtue of good positioning. I mean, that's pretty accurate, right? I think there are things we will nitpick, and I'm not saying it's perfect, and not saying there will be times where there will be implosion, I'm sure, but And keep in mind, like I don't think we've actually had a test yet where an opponent will press us very well. Girona did in the first half, and we looked uncomfortable. There'll be other moments where, for example, certain teams will just really psychologically be unable to deal with Real Madrid controlling the tempo the way they have been. There are teams who just have zero desire to have the ball at times, and they won't get rattled at all if they don't see it for like 100% of the game, and that's Atletico Madrid. And so for them to break Atletico psychologically by keeping the ball, it's almost impossible. They don't care. So there are tests that are going to be coming, which will be interesting to see how Lopetegui reacts to that. And I think it's going to be uber important to score first. I know that sounds kind of lame and cliche, but that's going to be a thing that we're going to need to do, I think, against teams like that. So having said that, what are the things that you think that this team does need to improve on?
I'm glad you asked that because that was what I wanted to go into. So one, I have two things, and I think they're connected somewhat. So the first would I think be, again, it's really early, so this could be, don't hold me to this. This could be something that ends up not being an issue, but I think verticality in possession is perhaps something that we might struggle with if it's somewhat late in the game, we're tied or we're down a goal. And we need to pick up the pace, and we need to get into the final third quicker. Because, like we said, our game plan is to control games and essentially just win games through sheer control and through the volume of our passes and the amount of time we have on the ball. Eventually, chances will appear, and we find them. But to be able to then force the issue requires that level of verticality, right? Like, I'm not saying long balls and just box. I'm saying you pick up position, you play this dagger ball through like two lines of defense into someone in the attacking third, and that sparks an attack instantly. And I think right now we're built really well for those sideways horizontal passes and those switches of plays to move up the field in a very indirect manner. And I wouldn't say I'm concerned, but I'm wondering how we would be able to just flick the switch and become more vertical. I think we have the tools. You have Benzema, Asensio, Bale, all very comfortable dropping deep and offering options there. But it is something I would also like to see more in game in control, right? Like in the Getafe game, when we didn't have that many chances, I perhaps would have liked to see Kroos, who is very, very good at finding vertical passes, be given more options that way. And, there weren't that many. And then the second point would, I think, I actually liked what I saw from Casemiro and how he was used. And I think he's been used the best way he has been so far. To be frank, I didn't really like him at all under Lopetegui's system in the past couple of games, but I thought this one was quite nice because almost every other game, Lopetegui has been playing him in a different way, trying to figure out how he can get Casemiro to work in his system. And this time, he did something that we haven't seen from Casemiro, like, in 3 years. I mean, I'm not even joking. I mean, like, because as soon as Zidane, like, essentially took over, and, like, Benitez didn't really have great attacking structure, but when Zidane took over, Casemiro was almost instantly, like, removed from possession, placed higher up the pitch in a number 10 when we were building from the back. And under Lopetegui, for the first time in a very long time, Casemiro was the deepest midfielder, and he stayed as the deepest midfielder for the entire game. So Casemiro was a lot more involved in build-up than we're used to seeing. I mean, most of his passes were still just very quickly off to Kroos or Modric. There weren't a lot of deep progressions, but he was involved in building from the back a lot. Kroos and Modric were not, encroaching in his space. They stayed wider. They stayed in the half spaces. They waited for Casemiro to find them. And for a team that didn't press, like Leganés didn't press us really that much throughout the game, I think if you were to look, the passes allowed for defensive action was 29.11. So we played 29.11 passes before they made a successful defensive action. So that is representative of a pretty much non-existent pressing for most of the time. So it was comfortable. It gave us nice structure. I think it made us a little flat to have Casemiro there because Kroos Modric was still coming deep. that's an easy workaround, right? Because then Ben's one, two of the wingers of the striker can just come a little deeper and it helps us progress. Structurally, having Casemiro there and forcing him to take responsibility and that phase of possession helps our structure a lot. Obviously, the issue is, what if Leganés had targeted Casemiro and used, because a lot of times, right, like when Casemiro receives the ball there, that's a pressing trigger for the team to move up the pitch and swarm around him. And we've seen multiple times he's lost the ball next to the box and it's dangerous. The next, like the issue is, okay, if that's the best for us structurally, what if teams press? Then what do we do then? Then does Casemiro get pushed high out of the way? And that's an issue that needs to be solved. And I'm very interested, like I've been saying, I'm very interested to see how Lopetegui tackles that. But for the moment, I'm pleased with what I saw from Casemiro and how he was used by Lopetegui.
Yeah, this question is very interesting. And so, by the way, back to that point, I think I was looking down. I was at this game, and I literally would just look, and I had to pinch myself because Casemiro was actually playing as an anchor and not as a false nine. And when you look at the shape, he was pretty well always behind Kroos and Modric. I think Kroos played a little bit deeper than Modric, and I think, and the way it unfolded on him, it almost looked like a double pivot. Because that was one of my other notes. Modric in this scheme, although his return in this game wasn't necessarily eventful, it was generally quiet on the stat sheet anyway, I thought it was good. And I think what we'll see, one of the biggest benefits in this scheme is that Modric looks freed because he no longer has to be running around trying to plug holes and cover for the right back and essentially be a martyr in a Zidane scheme where he essentially was playing right back. Because then you have Bale and Carvajal on the right flank, and Carvajal, by the way, had a good game and pretty much locked down Casemiro, and Kroos will play a bit deeper, and Modric can kind of pull strings as a 10 or of sorts in that role. But I think back to the Casemiro point, it's interesting because you mentioned what if they pressed him. And they didn't have to press him on like two occasions in my notes where he just gave the ball anyway without being pressed. The third time he did give it away when he was being pressed when he got the ball. Against Girona pressed a lot in the first half, but in the second half, even when they weren't pressing, Casemiro did also give the ball away a couple times. And also in this game, though, there were examples in the second half where he did a good job counter-pressing.
That was a notable thing.
To your question is, what happens when a team does this, and possibly if a solution is to kind of just go with Kroos back there and with Modric and Isco?
Or Marcos Llorente, who I still have faith.
Yeah, but I don't see that in a big game, do you?
I don't see it.
Yeah, so if Kroos, Modric, and Isco, and then the question is, does Kroos jogging back as an anchor hurt us at all? There's all these questions and dominoes, and you know, and then so you're really hoping you just control the game completely with that, and Modric and Isco can really help on in defensive transition. There's a lot of interesting questions in the big game because the way Benzema's playing, the way Asensio's playing, the way Bale's playing, the way Isco performed off the bench yesterday, it just, right at this moment in a very early stage, which, again, very small sample size, we have no idea. I'm not saying one thing or another. But in this very early stage, it really feels like Casemiro does seem like an odd man out in a big game because your other option is to bench Isco, which I'm not sure he does in a big game. He will in a game like this as a rotational piece, and we'll see rotations, but I'm very curious. I'm intrigued about what Lopetegui does in a big game.
Yeah, so I have something to say about that point, and then I have another thing I want to see improved. So this is why I think it's necessary to... I mean, I don't know what the issue is with Marcos Llorente and Lopetegui. I mean, there were rumors that he wasn't impressed with training. That is something that we are never going to be able to know about. Like, we don't go to training. We don't see what his attitude, his work rate is like. All I know is what I saw at Alaves was a very solid, fundamentally solid defensive midfielder. Like, obviously, Casemiro is superior defensively because the only other comparable defensive talent is N'Golo Kante, but not like putting Kroos at defensive. Well, Kroos just maybe isn't going to track back on the counterattack. Llorente is a hard worker. He's extremely sound positioning. I mean, as his defensive qualities are the strongest part of his game, that is what he's extremely good at. He will not be a liability there. You will not see him exposed as a defensive midfielder. And the advantage is perhaps he's not a world-class, you know, defender. He's only very good. But the advantage is he's a lot more press-resistant than Casemiro. And though he isn't perhaps like a Kroos-type vertical passer, he is a willing ball progressor, and he very much suits the side-to-side ball progression of Lopetegui. So to me, it is imperative, especially with Kovacic gone, who was the go-to defensive midfielder guy when we didn't want to play Casemiro. We have to mold him, we have to grow him, we have to give him time somehow, because then we don't really have the greatest alternative. I personally think in a Lopetegui system, Kroos is good 95% of the time, but I think Llorente would be good 100% of the time. So why can't we give him a shot? Why can't we help him grow? Why can't we give him game time? Because he is a great alternative. I don't think he displaces Casemiro anytime soon, but he certainly should be the number one backup option. And if we're not going to do that, I just think we're not developing a good resource that provides us with different tactical options. And I think it's a mistake. But then again, I don't see what happens in training. So maybe there's just something there that I'm missing completely. And then to the point about other things we can improve. Well, one thing I noticed in the game, especially in the first half, and it's sort of been a theme so far, is the issue of left-sided bias when we're attacking. I thought it would be better once Ronaldo left, but it's still the same because all the attackers we have just really enjoy the left side, except for maybe Lucas Vazquez. So whether that's Isco, Asensio, Benzema,
and Bale.
If you look at all their heat maps, even Bale spent a ton of time on the left. And I think in the first half, something I noticed was Bale and Asensio being on that left-hand side, either in the half space or on the wing, a lot, while Benzema was in the center, not really to the right, and that meant that all of our ball progression into the final third went through the left, and Leganés didn't have to pay attention to a switch or anything like that. I'd maybe like to see a bit more structure in the attacking with our attacking trio, but I don't know, maybe Lopetegui kind of likes that fluidity. Having a narrower, you know, formation like that is better for counter pressing sometimes. We'll see how it develops, but I think that hurt us in the first half, and then the second half got more balanced, and I don't think it was coincidental that we looked a lot better.
Well, we did have, I guess one of the benefits of having kind of a left side heavy, and not necessarily the left specifically, but just one of the benefits was all of a sudden Carvajal on the right-hand side by himself on the shoulder of the defensive line, Ramos hits him with a diagonal ball, he's gone. And we scored from that, right? That was the Bale opening goal. So I guess when everyone's on the left, all it takes is one player on the opposite flank for the whole defense to collapse if you hit the right ball. You kind of see a version of that, which is actually really deadly with Messi and Alba in Barca, where it's almost impossible to defend that because the cutting run Alba or Carvajal gets a touch on it, they can either square pass to someone else or actually head it on goal. It's hard to defend. So I think your point about Marcos. Yeah, I mean, everybody knows how much I love that guy, but I think. And he's been in the squad, I think, in both the last two games. He wasn't in the opening squad against Getafe, I think. I guess his issue is that, and again, a real thing that maybe a myth about this squad is that we don't have depth, but we really do, even with Kovacic gone. And if you look at the subs yesterday, because Marcos Llorente is never going to start over Casemiro, although to me, he's the prototypical person for this Lopetegui scheme because he can read the game. He has like that Busquets player comp to him where he can read the passing lanes, distribute quickly, needs to work on a bit of his vertical stuff, but I think that'll come and he's generally good at distributing the ball. But I think his problem is that he's not going to start over Casemiro or Kroos. And with Lopetegui's subs, like Isco came in yesterday, no brainer. Lucas Vasquez, I don't, you know, Lucas Vasquez is always going to be a good sub, whether you need a goal or whether you need to defend a goal. And Dani Ceballos brings you the control that Lopetegui would want to close a game with. So I think that's Llorente's issue right now, is just that. Like, I can justify Llorente starting, but I can also justify everyone else who was on the pitch over him. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. I mean, maybe I was going too far because again, I'm kind of relying on rumors. Who even knows that true? But I impression I've gotten again, very small sample size, so I could my assessments here could be illogical. I'm getting the sense that Lopetegui doesn't really trust Llorente. Maybe there, I'm just not speaking on enough information, and I should just like keep quiet and just wait and see, because I'm not gonna really know anyway. But that's just, there's just that feeling I get, and if it is true, it bothers me a little bit because I really do think this guy can provide us with something that Casemiro doesn't provide us without compromising our defensive stability. I mean, because that's the main issue, right? Like if you're putting Kroos or Kovacic there, you can successfully and convincingly argue that okay, they're a lot better against presses. Our progression gets a lot better, but can they stop counterattacks, or can they plug gaps in the midfield the way Casemiro can? There is no, like I couldn't argue that. But Llorente, I don't think it's at the level of Casemiro, but again, no one's at the level except Conte, but Llorente is not a liability there. He will stop that 99% of the time. And that's my issue. But then again, like I said, I could be wrong, and I certainly hope that I'm just making a lot of this stuff up, like all the worries.
Well, I guess we don't know, but I think all it takes is for one or two games for Llorente to, I guess, blow our minds. And that's kind of all it takes to get in the team. We've seen plenty of examples in the past of players who impress for one game and then two games, and then all of a sudden it's just like a no-brainer that this guy needs to play more. So like if Llorente gives us a couple of those in his brief opportunities, then he's 23. Casemiro is 26 now. Casemiro wasn't until he was what, 24, where he started to actually play a role with us. I guess there's time. And yeah, you know, like no one wants Llorente to succeed as much as I do. So I hope what you're saying is I guess overthought about, because I think we all know how talented he is. Are there any other things that you wanted to discuss about this game before we move to questions?
I mean, I'm just no, I guess this is going to be asked in questions anyway, but I don't have anything to say.
Well, I think we both agree Benzema. Maybe we can talk
But
about
that was what I
Bale.
was going to.
Yeah, Benzema we
I
have
wasn't going to
questions
talk
about.
about it anyway.
Yeah, Benzema we have questions, but we'll save it. Bale, any notes on him?
Another impressive performance. I don't think it was as good as the last game, but he was good. He scored the opening goal. I mean, it's like we said, he understands the responsibility placed on his shoulders. He's embraced it, and he's our best attacker. I just pray that he stays fit, because I really do believe that with Bale leading this team, we have a very strong shot at winning La Liga.
Yeah.
And it depends on his injury. So if but I really do think like 30 La Liga goals is not out of question if he stays fit.
There was one sequence where there was a counterattack in the second half, and Real Madrid were already in Leganés' third, and Benzema had the ball on the flank. And I'm just like, oh, great, this is a great opportunity for Bale. And then I realized Bale's not even in the attack, like at all. And I look back to see where he was, and he's in the defensive third. And he starts running. And within seconds, he's the one who gets on the ball,
Oh, I
like,
remember that,
yeah. And Kroos played a through ball to him. And his speed is ridiculous. Like, that's the kind of athleticism and speed that you're just like, okay, he looks really healthy. And that is encouraging.
Do you remember last season when people were saying that he wasn't as fast as he used to be and that his pace was gone off like literally nothing? Like I'm glad that turned out to not be true.
Marcelo, I guess, is one person, like, defensively has not been great this year until now. He wasn't good against Girona defensively. There were a couple of times, especially in the first half in this game, where he kind of actually just got ripped apart with kind of, he had someone in front of him and had all the time in the world to close them, and he just couldn't. And he got dribbled past and they just got a cross in. But offensively, like, just his passing, man, is just so dangerous. Like, every, I don't even know how else to put it. He's offensively, he's a freak.
That's what I think we don't emphasize enough about Marcelo. We all talk about his dribbling, his offensive like production, and then we also talk about defensive weaknesses. But this is coming from watching a lot of Guardiola over the past couple of years, watching the evolving role of the fullback. And something that hasn't been mentioned enough is how it just isn't enough for full pseudo wingers. They also have to be central midfielders as well, especially with Guardiola using inverted fullbacks. I mean, I don't know if you're watching City games, but if that kind of stuff interests you, I urge you to watch, because he's doing all kinds of funky things with fullbacks. His fullbacks have to be central midfielders, and they have to, another second, they have to burst down the overlap and be an attacking fullback again. And I think if Marcelo played in that kind of system, he could do all of those roles. That's how good he is. And his contribution in build-up is not something we appreciate enough, because his passing range, his passing ability, and his decision-making when passing the ball into the attacking third is second to none from his position, in my opinion. And that is extremely valuable, right? Because you usually consider build-up happening from the center. You have central figures, you have the center backs, and you have the central midfielders. But imagine how valuable it is to have someone who picks up the ball on the left and isn't just content to pass it back or just dribble down the flank. He looks up and he can hit vertical daggers from the diagonal into an attacker, or he can play a switch ball on the volley towards Carvajal on the other side. That's ridiculous, and it adds a total another dimension to our attack, and it adds different angles through which we can penetrate opposition defenses. And Marcelo's been doing this for a long time, and I think we've seen tons of it already this season because of how much of the ball we have. And that's just something to watch out for as it goes on, because Marcelo is entering that age where soon he's going to be post prime, and we should really appreciate watching players like this.
We'll take some questions on Patreon. So if you're listening to this, you probably already know we have a Patreon page where you can get all kinds of different awards. You can get access to at least two extra shows per week. We have one episode per week on Tuesdays where we keep track of the players on loan, and the list has grown now. We have Andre Lunin, we have Odegaard, we have Borja Mayoral is the latest one, Achraf Hakimi, Oscar Rodriguez. Who else? Kovacic. Anyone else own? Is that it? It's a long list. Oh, Raul de Tomas, I guess we still own. So we do a weekly segment where we record a podcast to update you on all them, as well as we bring on Sam Sharp to update you guys on Castilla. So that's a bonus show we do every Wednesday. We do a bonus show. So if there's a Champions League, Copa del Rey game, or a mailbag, that also goes up on patreon.com/managingmadrid. So if you want A, access to those shows, and B, get rewards like guaranteed responses to your questions, patreon.com/managingmadrid. Please consider supporting our show. So the first question is from Daniel Smith. He says, "Keon, I saw you attended the Castilla game. Did you see Taki bite Vinicius Jr.? What was the reaction like in the stands? Did you see this bite, by the way?"
Yeah,
Yeah.
first thing when I woke up on Twitter
Yeah, it was an
or
early
logged onto my
kickoff.
laptop. Yeah,
Yeah. And thoughts?
I mean, I don't know, the picture was kind of inconclusive. It certainly looked like he was trying to bite him, but I don't know, I didn't see the
Oh,
video.
the video is clear. He actually goes in like a lion and actually tries
That's
to bite,
that
take
is
flesh out of his skull.
that is crazy.
I guess to the question of what was the reaction from where we were sitting, you couldn't really see that there was a bite, and there's no replays in that stadium. So this was in Atletico Madrid's B stadium, by the way. It's in Majadahonda. It's called Wando, Ciudad Wando de Deportivo, or something like that, de Majadahonda. And in those stands, you can't really, all we saw was that Vinicius got in a scuffle with an Atleti player, and there was kind of like something breaking out, and everyone was like yelling. But I don't think anybody saw or knew that there was a bite that way, because you can't really see because it was on the ground and there was players kind of crowding them. Then when I saw the video after, I was blown away. I was like, this is insane. This, like, really, Sam Sharp put it, actually worded it perfectly. He said, this is mental. It's a crazy reaction. I will say this, it's interesting. That stadium, like, it, the press zone is like, really, it's not even a press zone, because you show up and I'm like, okay, where do I sit with my laptop? And he's like, just go find a seat that there's no fan sitting in. I was like, oh, okay. So I went and I tried to find the chair closest to Vinicius in the corner on the left flank in the first half. And he has this persona about him that I don't want to say he's a provoker, but, like, you know how Neymar, the way he plays stylistically, if there is something, if he's not on your team, you just hate him because there's something about him that provokes you.
Well, Vinicius has been open about the fact that he tries to emulate Neymar, so that surprised me. And I've always generally been on the side of entertainers and tricksters, because I've always thought it's kind of dumb. Like, you're literally just going to kick this person because they're that good at football. Like,
Yeah, of course.
that's idiotic to me. But I understand why people feel that way, but I think it's really cool that within his second game, the opposition sees him as such a threat. They have to do wild shit, like take a chunk out of his head. Like, that's just cool to me. And I think it speaks to already the fact that he has this aura. People know when he has the ball, he's gonna do something amazing, like that crazy golazo he scored that you posted on Twitter, Keon. Like, that was an insane goal.
Well, that was interesting. And maybe getting a bit off topic here to Daniel's question about the bite, but so the fans were also just like on his back, because they were all Atleti fans and they were just trying to get in his head and stuff. One thing I thought was kind of cool, rarely in a Segunda B game do you see like good tactics from the opposition, and Atletico Madrid B were like an exception to this, where I thought, like, really they try to instill certain values in their youth team, like to just get them acquainted with the club's philosophy. And so, like, they were very organized defensively. Like, they pressed the center backs and immediately went to the wing backs and made Real Madrid's wing backs uncomfortable. And Real Madrid's full backs are actually good, and that's like one of their bright spots over the past couple of years. But they were struggling, like, really. And I thought the one edge they had psychologically was just Vinicius, because he had this attitude about him where he would walk on the pitch and he's like, guys, I'm just kind of too good to be here. I'm going to just do a bunch of things and score a couple goals and get in. And he was like sticking up to Atleti players. He was getting in their faces. I thought that really gave them a psychological edge, which kind of got me excited. Don't get me wrong, like, he's raw as hell, man. Like, my tweet, I think, overhyped like too many people, because it was just a goal in the end. It was a great goal, but his decision making needs a ton of polishing. But but I will, like, he did try like a rainbow kick, and it was embarrassing. And but he's clearly, like, he has something about him that kind of you're definitely allowed to get excited about. And I guess that psychological factor is part of it. I did talk to Solari after the game, and I because he kind of disappeared in the first half, and this is my biggest takeaway from that conversation, Om, was that because in the first half Vinicius was getting on a bunch of counters and he was the highest man on the pitch, even higher than the striker Dani Gomez, and he was just kind of, and they were getting him the ball and he was dangerous in the counterattack on the left wing. In the second half, he just completely disappeared. Like, he did not touch the ball. Everything was going to Castilla's right flank, and he literally was so isolated. And I asked Solari about it, and he said, look, like, Atleti just, like, put, like, three people on him and didn't let him get the ball, and that was it. I was like, well, should he just at least drop deeper to so he doesn't get isolated? And Solari, his answer was interesting, because he said, no, like, we don't want him to defend at all. Like, he just needs to conserve his energy for the attack, and
Interesting.
he candidly said, like, Vinicius is not really here to do that stuff. He's literally here to just play as much as he can so that he's ready for the first team. Like, it was very, like, open about it. He was like, he's not here to, like, do defensive stuff for us. He's just there to play football and get in shape. like that was my takeaway from that conversation, which was interesting, but
That's interesting
yeah.
for reasons. One, you'd think that getting him into that work ethic would be really good for him as a player, especially
Yeah.
because Lopetegui's side likes to press. I mean, spoke about the passes allowed per defensive numbers against Leganés for us, 5.87. So we allowed on average 5.87 before we made a successful defensive action. That is representing a very high press. So like, I don't know, man. Like, if we wanted him to get a playing time and we want him to really like grow, like, I don't see why we couldn't have kept him in Brazil and why he has to be here, where like
I agree.
in a place where like dudes are like grown dudes are trying to like a bite out of his head. Like, I mean,
It's
I
true. It's
like.
true. I mean, look, Segunda Bay is a rough place. Like that, it is what it is.
But yeah, like, yeah, it is interesting. I'm glad that you got an honest answer, because managers can be quite evasive for good reasons. But that's a very useful tidbit of info. Very interesting.
Yeah, I got lucky because I didn't talk to them in the press conference. I actually got him in the hallway one-on-one. So I think he was a bit more candid. Whereas I think if we, but he is like actually genuinely like if Zidane was boring and political, Solari will actually kind of be a bit more open, which is nice. But Sajid Reyes has a question. And there's a couple questions here that have to do with Benzema, so we'll chunk them together. So Sajid says, with Benzema's resurgence and all his haters jumping on the Benz wagon, I would like you guys to elaborate on the concept of hold-up play for a number nine and why this is so important for a team. Because I think Benzema is the best in the world in this facet of his game, even when his finishing was bad for the last couple seasons.
So,
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, this is different enough from this to the other Benzema questions that we can take it. Go ahead.
yeah, I just wanted to quickly make a distinction between hold up play and link up play, because those are terms that are thrown around. Like, they are different things, right? Like, if you think about hold up play, that's something that strikers have traditionally been good at. Like, you think of the classic target man. So, Edin Dzeko or Olivier Giroud, like, can take a direct into their path, or perhaps, like, really tough ball and just kind of fend defenders off, hold on to possession, and wait for attackers to move off the pitch. Whereas link up play is more about getting others actively involved and recycling possession and creating things. So when Benzema is a different hold up player, but he's more about link up play. So it's about, like, he'll much, much deeper than someone who would stay up near the line to hold up play. He would come deep into midfield to help progress the ball up the pitch, and then he'll move wide a lot to help connect with players on the flank, maybe rotate with Ronaldo, and go out to the left wing and feed crosses into him. So like, they're two different things. And I think Sajid was perhaps referring to the link up one. And well, I mean, why it's important because it gives another dimension to your entire team, right? Like, would you rather have a limited forward who only scores, or would you rather have a complete forward who does score and can contribute in build up, that can bring others into the attack, that can assist? And this was Benzema for the large majority of his career. A very respectable score. I mean, he's top 5 in the Champions League, top 10, I think, in Real Madrid's history in terms of total goals, and his creation numbers are fantastic. And I think especially when you are playing with a prolific wide forward, it becomes absolutely essential to have a forward that will drop deep, willing to swap positions, willing to feed the wide attackers as their primary role. And people kind of like to use this to talk about how selfish Ronaldo is, like almost like an attack, right? Like, Ronaldo like ruined Benzema. But if you look at any prolific wide forward, that's always been the case. Like, the key dynamic for Liverpool last year was Firmino dropping deep and helping Salah be the main, focal point of the attack. And that's why Salah scored, was top scorer in the league, broke the record for most goals in a Premier League season. Even Messi, when he played as a right wing under Luis Enrique, people didn't give Luis Suarez enough credit for playing a similar role to Benzema. Obviously, the dynamic was a bit different because Messi is a prolific creator himself, but Suarez also sacrificed a lot. Messi took the most shots on that team, and he still does. So that's why it's useful, because if you have and it allows, like, I know I'm talking a lot, Kim. I'll try to, but
no, please go for it.
It allows you to essentially have more goals on your team, because think about what most wingers provide you, right? Like, you're talking, like, someone as good as Eden Hazard will provide you, like, max 15, 18 goals a season in maybe 22 in all competitions. And the striker is always, if you look at all strikers, top-class strikers, they all score goals. Now, imagine if you could put a prolific goal scorer on the wing, maybe reduce the number of goals that your striker scores by a little bit, but still have a prolific goal scorer there. Like, you just adds up, right? That's why statistically a goal scorer on the wing is worth more than a goal scorer in the center, because it adds more goals to your team, because there just aren't that many wingers who score goals. So in so many ways, a more complete forward who can link up play and bring others into the attack, who's comfortable moving wide and dropping deep, gives your team so much more. And that's why for so long we've talked about what Benzema does, even when he's not scoring, even when he's not at his best, he always provides something useful. And that's simply why we've said it. And that's why we'll continue to emphasize it, why we'll continue to look at forwards to see, like, what are the forwards we can buy that bring this. Harry Kane perhaps brings a lot of these qualities. So, I mean, that's why we say it's important. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if you have much to add to that, Keon. I said a lot there. I kind of went on and on.
No, that's good. I think you said everything that was important, and I think anything I would do would probably just rehash what you said. But I mean, like, the term link-up play, which everyone hated last year because Benzema wasn't scoring.
People fucking hated it.
Yeah, but they're going to love that term this year because Benzema is scoring. And so now link-up play maybe will be less traumatic to say every week. But the thing with link-up play is that you, like, just, there are so many things that you can do in modern football. And with your striker these days needing to do more, and Firmino is a great example. There are others, like, long gone to me are, like, the very, very traditional just poachers who really just, you know, like the pure nines who can only just play as a nine. I think even the most extreme examples, you know, in this I guess this era, even like with Lewandowski, can do more. Like, I think with Benzema, like, the whole link-up play is the more you have players dropping deep and more interchangeability, and it's more options to cut through a defensive line that is stubborn, and it's less predictable because you have more movement, less stagnancy. And if you're, and don't get me wrong, like, that striker should be able to score. And how many times did Benzema have a great chance last season and not take it? If he starts taking those in conjunction to just being confident and dropping deep and, you know, doing other things, like, you need to have plenty of people who can link up. It's not just him, by the way. It's not just him who needs to link up, like, and connect the dots and drop deep. Like, Asensio and Bale, in a way, connect the same way. And the more people you have who can do that, the more options and more incisiveness you'll have. And that's the type of thing you'll need, especially if you're a team like Real Madrid, who is going to face a lot of low defensive blocks. You can't have a nine who can't do that stuff, you know? On the same note, Anthony Lombardi says, let's just talk about how Benzema is leading the La Liga in goals with the grin emoji. My question is, can you highlight details in how Lopetegui's changes reinvented Benzema, as his form is top quality now?
Okay, so very interesting to me, because I don't think, like, anything has really changed at the moment.
Yeah.
But, like, I have a really tiny sample size. Like, we sometimes search for really big answers to big changes we see. And I'm just gonna look at the numbers here. So for Karim Benzema, his number of shots that he took, let me just get to it. Okay. The number of shots that he took per 90 minutes last season was 2.62. Over the four La Liga games this season, the number of shots he took per 90 minutes is 2.67. So that's no difference. But what about the quality of the shots? His XG per 90 last season, 0.58. His XG per 90 this season, 0.61. Now, here's the difference. If you look at his expected goal total from last season, 13.97. How many goals did he actually score? 5. If you look at his expected goals this season, 1.83, he scored 4 goals. Yeah. So I do expect, as everyone gels, start creating more chances for Benzema to get more shots off, get more high quality chances, simply because of the fact that the main focal point is on and other people have to step up, and Benzema has to be one of those guys. But in the present moment, all that has changed is Benzema has become more confident and he's taking his chance.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's not a satisfactory answer because it's not a big reason, but if you look at the evidence, that's all that's really changed.
Him and Bale combined for 9 shots yesterday. So like that kind of uptick in, I guess, just getting to create shots is there this season. Although, like, you know, who knows what will happen once everything normalizes and the stats normalize. But Lopetegui was actually asked this question at the press conference yesterday, and he basically just said, don't give me credit for anything that Benzema's doing differently, because to be honest, it's just his confidence and him mm-hmm. stepping up. And that's what Lopetegui said. Now, maybe that's just also being him humble, but also, like, as you noted, what's really that different on the pitch? Like, I would say the movement from him this season is pretty much the same. I guess, I think in a way it does make it easier for him that the way Asensio and Bale are moving is conducive to his play as well, because again, like, this goes back to the point of zero stagnancy under Lopetegui in the final third. Nobody is ever standing around, and it seems to me that Bale, Asensio and Benzema are on the same wavelength, and you watch the three and two of them are always playing on the defensive line and one of them is dropping and they're in sync with which one is doing which. You mentioned Bale was on the left flank quite a bit with Asensio, and also there were times where Bale and Asensio would just swap flanks and Benzema was dropping deeper in the middle and kind of just it was very, very fluid. And so I think in to some extent Lopetegui is a bit humble to say that I'm, you know, it's not me. At the same time, he's right. I think those movements from Benzema existed last season just fine, but it is a lot of confidence.
If you think about the goals that he scored, they were not easy chances at all. The first one, a header, where he had a defender on him. He had no, like, backlift. He didn't even jump. It was just pure placement.
Yeah.
A really high-quality finish. And then the second one was a combination near the edge of the box, and then he takes it. The angle is against him. He has to turn a little bit to be able to hit it, and he just hits it so cleanly, and it rocked
it was a tough
to
one.
The bottom corner. Right, he's not scoring those goals last season with his confidence and form.
No, but it did remind me of goals he was scoring a few years ago.
Yeah, this is Benzema deciding that, and he admitted it, right? Like, he admitted that he wasn't good enough, and then he needed to improve. And I think the faith, if anything, what helped him in this present moment, looking at the present sample size, what the team did to help him was show a huge amount of faith. I mean, like, the Real Madrid social media accounts over the summer every week were posting, you know, these videos of Benzema and, like, basically saying he's our guy. He's our main striker. Lopetegui never once in any press conference doubted him. Real Madrid never really looked at a striker option to replace him. So the faith that Benzema has been shown, I think, has helped restore his confidence. It's undoubtedly rose last season. And, you know, I'm pretty on believing in all these psychological tricks, because I think players believe in a lot of this a lot. And I think the club did a good job of supporting him, and I think it's bearing fruit before there's been real systemic changes in Benzema's role.
Mark Rady says, is it the system or are we seeing the return of Carvajal to top form? He's been solid in defense and attack recently. Also, Benzema can't score goal. Yes, thank you for reminding us of that, Mark. I guess we did forget to talk about Carvajal a little bit. I thought this was his best game in a long time.
Yeah, I would agree. Again, I'm systemic because Zidane relied on his fullbacks like more than any other coach I've seen in a very long time. In like the traditional sense, like he needs his fullbacks to get down the flank and provide attacking options. And it actually, if you were a fullback under Zidane's system, you would have enjoyed yourself a lot. I just think it's the fact that Odriozola in. And he has some competition now. I mean, Odriozola obviously hasn't played yet, but I think just even having that guy in training,
Yeah.
you know, a very, very talented young player who wants to play, who definitely didn't be out of place and start a big game with us, pushing him in, you know, again, another psychological thing helps. And we've discussed this before, how, you know, the 2 seasons where Carvajal hasn't played particularly, at least to his standards, were the 2 seasons where he really had no competition. So I think that's what it is. Again, see, this was one game. We'll see if he keeps this up, but I'm optimistic for Carvajal's form this season.
Well, I definitely agree about the Odriozola point, and defensively he was good. It was his run and touch from getting that Ramos diagonal pass, which created the opening goal. Maybe crazy overlooked in all this is he actually had 4 key passes. Him and Asensio led the team in that department. So
And
I,
he had the assist to
yeah,
Bale,
he
right?
had the
Yeah.
assist. Yeah. Question from Essa Hariri and Blake Brown, both about Mariano. So Essa says, "Hey guys, I want to ask about my boy Mariano. I lost hope of him coming back when he left to Lyon, but man, it was joyful to him to see him with us again. But why did he get number 7? Was it a marketing strategy Real Madrid used to lure him back? Or was it a strong message from the club that number 7 is theirs, and no matter who wore it before, they decide who gets it next? Real Madrid with the 7 shirt is always great, and not Raul nor Ronaldo in any players. The club is bigger than any player. Thanks. Sorry, the wording was a bit weird there. I had to kind of reshuffle it." But and then Blake Brown also says, "So I know you guys have talked about this before, but I don't like Mariano getting the 7. He will be our backup striker. That doesn't feel like someone deserving of the 7 for Real Madrid. What do you guys think if we had to wait a year to hand it out? I am fine with that." So this is blown up a lot because Mariano got the 7. I thought, so I never really got a chance to talk to you all about the signing, but I thought I was really happy with Mariano coming back. I think it solves a lot of issues in terms of depth at that position. I definitely didn't expect him to walk in and be a starter, and that's not what I really was looking for anyway. I was just looking for someone other than Mayoral to bring on and have confidence, because Mayoral's just his goal to game ratio has been good for the last 2, 3 years. He outperforms his expected goals, and expected goals is also like was fourth in Ligue 1 in terms of the quality of chances he gets to. I was really happy with the signing. I think he's a really good. It was a really smart to bring him back, and ideal for me because he also, we send him out 1 year to Lyon. Like I think we all would have liked to keep him, but at the same time, if we did, we wouldn't have seen him progress like he did under Lyon. So he comes back as a better player. Ideal, all of that. And then this whole number 7 thing that really blew up, and a lot of people just think it's crazy. Who cares? It's just a number. A lot of people really felt like offended by this, and the club was disrespecting Ronaldo. Where do you stand on all this?
So first of all, I agree with everything you said about Mariano. I really like him as a player. I mean, he's really only good at one thing, but the one thing that he's good at is he's very good at, which is getting shots off in high quality situations and then getting good shots in low situations. So I think that provides us with something very useful off the bench. And if Benzema is injured, I'm not too worried when Mariano comes in. So as to the number 7 issue, I have no problem with it. So a lot of people told me they would have preferred Asensio to have gotten it, and I'm sure the club would have wanted to do that or would have loved to do that. But if he didn't get it, it's probably because Asensio didn't want it. And the fact that Mariano got it tells me that this guy went and asked the club for it. I don't think the club brought in Mario thinking this guy's our number seven, this guy's our Ronaldo replacement. He was bought to be a backup striker. That Mariano went out of his way to ensure that he got it. And if Mariano went out of his way to ask for it, I'm totally cool with it. And it's not like the club can deny him. Then what message does it send to your player if you say, no, I'm sorry, man, like, you're not worthy of the shirt. Like, you can't take seven. Like, that's just going to – it's a very risky game to say that to a player, right? If someone wants it and they have the confidence to take that shirt, that means it's only going to – I mean, did you guys see his presentation at the Bernabeu? Like, the way he was juggling the ball. I mean, the dude was an absolute pimp. I mean, like, he was confident on hell, like, confident as hell, bordering on, like, cocky almost the way he was doing. We saw, like, Ousmane Dembele's presentation. I mean, fantastic player. I'm not saying this, like, makes you, like, great or anything. He was nervous. And even Ronaldo, Mariano, he missed like a couple juggles, you know, he wasn't really doing any tricks or anything. Mariano was doing tricks, he was juggling the ball, he was balanced on his neck. Like, this guy wants the number seven shirt. He's an academy player who's probably dreamed about, you know, wearing the most legendary shirt of all time. If he wants it, this, it's only going to help him. It's going to improve his self-belief, which improves the performance on the pitch, and that means that it helps the team's performance, and that matters at the end of the day. I mean, we all know this is a transitionary period. Eventually, the number seven shirt will be passed on to a big name signing. Sometimes there are periods like this. Alfredo Di Stefano's number went to some random dude. Like, and that's just how it is sometimes. And there's no point in getting angry. Like, there really isn't. Like, you can just look at the positives and just move on, because I think it has a lot of positives.
Yeah, on one hand, the number seven at Real Madrid has historically been an important number with a big burden. Like, it's just, and I'm not saying that's how it should be or that's, you know, that's what it needs to be, but that's just historically what it's been. Like, that's a real thing that, you know, the players, if you look at who've worn it in the past, whether it's Raul or Butragueño or Amancio or Juanito, etc. They've all been, I think Raymond Kopa also wore it. They've all been great players and legends. And also the other thing is that they've all had to carry this embodiment of Madridismo. It's like being a leader on the pitch, carrying the club's values, all that. On the other hand, it's a number. And what is the use of getting angry about it, like you said? I think all those situations that you brought up are entirely plausible. One, Asensio didn't want it. B, Mariano asked for it. And what kind of messages is sent to him if they say, you're not worthy of this number? We have no idea what the discussions behind the scenes were. And that's something that people just always fail to take into account. They think that, I mean, I have no idea what they think, but they really just have no idea what the internal discussions are. There was also, I will say, between Butragueño and Raul, there was like a brief, I don't even know if it lasted a full year, if it was 6 months, that Juan Schneider wore it like in 96 for a few months between the club gave it to Raul. And even when they gave it to Raul, they had no idea what he was going to become. He was a teenager. I mean, isn't it kind of unfair to say Mariano was not worthy of it? Let's just wait and see, because we had no idea Raul was going to shatter a bunch of records and become one of the greatest players in club history. Now, Mariano's 25, a bit older, fair. But, I mean, I think it's also just a bit unfair to him to just make so much noise about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's the point that a lot of people feel that this was intentional to kind of slap Ronaldo a bit.
I don't think the club gets anything out of that. If anything, I think the club is dreading the moment when, like, Ronaldo gets someone to ghostwrite a book about his career and he talks about what went down at Real Madrid. Because we all know Real Madrid doesn't have the best reputation about writing legends. I mean, we couldn't even do it properly with Casillas. The club doesn't want anyone to talk about this any longer than it has to be done, because when a player is with the club he can't really speak his narrative, but the second he leaves, he's free to pretty much say whatever he wants. We saw Pepe when he left. He said some negative things about Zidane. He said negative things about the fans. I think we've seen other players leave and talk about how, like, you know, the fans are harsh and that kind of thing, things they would have never said when they were with the club unless they had a leadership position like Ramos and Ronaldo did. Real Madrid wants us to forget about this as quickly as possible and move on to the next generation and not, like, you know, kind of pick up the carpet and reevaluate all the issues that we swept under it. So the idea that we decided just to spite him just doesn't seem like a smart move. It's something that would benefit Ronaldo's narrative or hurt the club by continuing that kind of like cycle of anger that some Ronaldo fans have toward the club of the way Ronaldo was treated. So it's far fetched to me. I mean, I don't buy it, but I mean, again, like, who knows? We're just like making things up.
I can't wait for that Ronaldo book, by the way. That, and I also can't wait for Zidane to publish a book sometime, maybe 10, 20 years from now, where he basically just tells us exactly what happened this summer. Like, where he just actually just comes outright and tells us, I knew all this was going to happen and I just left before. It's because I didn't want to deal with it.
I mean, that's what I think it was. But yeah, I would be even more interested to see what Zidane had to say. But yeah, until then, I think there's no use speculating about it and like stirring the emotions and then kind of making people angry off of nothing. There's no point to that. It's not logical.
Shay Khatiri says Benzema can't score goal. That's the subject of his post. I wonder if there's anyone new with this podcast this season who doesn't understand this inside joke, but just in case you don't get it, this is an inside joke that we had someone who obsessively would send this to us. Emails, private messages, comments, Twitter, Facebook. Every week, Benzema can't score a goal. So now it's a worldwide phenomenon. Shay says, Cristiano might have been a Ferrari, but Benz is still a great ride. I love Ray. I guess this is a Ray Hudson quote. I'm not sure. Marcelo gave a poor pass to Courtois, which passed... Oh, this is a separate sentence. I love Ray. Marcelo gave a poor pass to Courtois, which passed the goal line and became a corner kick. It was totally Marcelo's fault, but Ray said that Kaylor would not have allowed it to become a corner.
I don't think he said that.
Okay, I have no idea. I didn't watch the DNP.
I think he raised the question initially. He's like, if Kaylor was there, would he? And then he quickly was like, nah. Because he very clearly said at the end of like a couple lines, I don't think Kaylor would have stopped it. But I think the point Shay is kind of trying to like say, because he says afterwards, Marcelo and Kaylor can do no wrong. I mean, yeah, and Ray loves those two players. Like, I've never seen a bigger Kaylor Navas fanboy than Ray Hudson. So I think he was being pretty objective in that moment, but there's no doubting that you will defend Kaylor to the death.
Yeah. Shay also says, what is Ramos's role under Lopetegui? I only caught the second half. On several occasions and when we were on offense, he was positioned ahead of Kroos and Casemiro and kind of looked like a left winger. Do you think it is something Julen asked him to do? Or is it just one of the greatest defenders in the history having not made peace with the fact that he is not a forward? Do you have any notes on Ramos's positioning at all?
I don't think I like saw what Shay is describing, Ramos on the left wing when he was positioned ahead of Kroos and Casemiro, like, I noticed that. So either one of us is right, or, you know, I just didn't pay attention enough. What I will say, though, is that this is an interesting question because Ramos has always been more than a defender. I don't even know if that's correct to say now, because speaking about the roles of fullbacks, the roles of central defenders have evolved. They have to be good on the ball if you play with a good team. And if you play in a possession-based system, and under Lopetegui, that just becomes more and more important. You mentioned this, Keon, very early in the podcast when we were discussing, you know, the left-sided bias, and you discussed Ramos's diagonals to Carvajal. Mm-hmm. Ramos is a really, really, really good passer. And he provides us with excellent ball progressibility from the defensive third straight into the final third. And that is going to be extremely useful for a team that wants to progress play by switching play from side to side. Ramos can also play a wicked vertical pass. You know, he can dribble his way out of pressure if pass isn't on and he doesn't want to just lump the ball away. His role kind of expanded on from what we've seen, because Ramos has always been this player, but because we'll have ball, because we're patient, because we will look to control the game, Ramos will be, you know, a central midfielder position as a central, essentially.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the positioning on the left, I didn't see so much. I think Varane has actually probably hedged more to the right than Ramos was on the left. But I think his positioning, I think it was also, he was a bit higher than Varane. And the nature of Lopetegui pinning opponents and keeping possession in the opponent's half, Ramos is going to play higher because the defensive line will be higher. Also, we know he does like to get up the field. I guess one thing to back this up is that he did have 34 touches in the opponent's half. And
I think I know what Shay's talking about. Because there were moments when Ramos like dribbled up the pitch, and because he was a left center back, and when we're in possession, the center back split wide. He dribbled up the pitch to kind of incite a press onto him to create space behind before he releases a ball. This is a concept a lot of like tactically inclined analysts and coaches love, like the center back driving up the pitch with the ball to provoke, you know, pressure onto him, then to create space in behind. And yeah, a couple of times when Ramos did that, obviously because Casemiro was sitting in the hole, he was behind him, and because Kroos, as you mentioned, was a little deeper to help control the game, you know, Ramos would push past ahead of them. But it wasn't like his position off the ball. It was something like he was creating himself to when he was dribbling with it.
Yeah,
so
that's what I'm saying. He had a lot of touches in the opponent's half. Some of those were just him coming over the halfway line to kind of play as a deep distributor, but also just also getting high up the pitch. I think that's pretty accurate, like everything what you said as well. But again, I think also just a byproduct of the higher that Real Madrid play up the pitch, the higher he's going to get by default as well. I guess the last question, Adrian Rios, another controversial discussion incoming. Thoughts on Ronaldo not showing up to the awards? I know players know ahead of time who's not going to be awarded, and that's why Messi, Kroos, and Varane didn't show up. I don't know how true that is necessarily. But Adrian goes on to say, I find it strange that Ronaldo didn't show up despite winning Forward of the Year. I also saw that his agent, Mendes, called it shameful that Ronaldo didn't win, and the Juve director also was highly critical of the award. Should Ronaldo do more to stop his agent from saying these things, considering his ex-teammate won the award? Adding this to the low-key shots fired from Ronaldo and his camp, example saying Juve is more of a family, I'm starting to get a bad taste from a player I consider a Madrid legend. What are your thoughts?
So, I know for a fact that Messi didn't show up for one of the awards. I mean, it was the award, like we were discussing before the podcast, Keon. That's not an issue to me. Like, I think I could be wrong, but at least with the UEFA award, like the players are told beforehand. Only for like the one where Ronaldo like was standing on the tower, he had to have been told beforehand. So he decided not to show up. I don't think anyone really made an issue over Messi missing it, so I don't know why it'd be an issue over Ronaldo missing it. Mendes's comments, I can understand why that pissed a lot of people off. I mean, I don't really know how I feel about this, because I think, especially with agents like Mendes and Iola, the players kind of let them control everything. And they only like give them very direct order, like, I want to leave the club, then do something. Otherwise, it is just up the agent. You know, they've trusted, like, we know, like, Ronaldo Mendes, like, he's his father. And so it's just up to Mendes to, like, you know, talk up his player however he can. So, like, I personally don't get offended by what Mendes said, because it's his job to say whatever nonsense necessary to to continue to boost his player. Whether Ronaldo could have stopped it or not, I don't know. Ronaldo could have put out a statement, but I don't know if it would have been, you know, wise to contradict his own agent. Like, that's all, like, again, like, how much do we really know? I mean, you can take it whichever way you want to. You know, then Ronaldo saying that Juve is more of a family. I mean, I don't know if that's really a shot, is it? Like, I think he's just describing just how he feels there. And also, you have to remember, like, Ronaldo is trying to endear himself to the Juventus fans. It's like a quote kind of taken out of context to, like, create, like, this, like, false, like, friction. I mean, I think, like, the Mendes, like, I understand, like, there's a bit more to that, but the Juve is more of a family, like, I mean, so what? Like, what if Juve is more of a family? Like, what does that mean? Like, I don't really see how that's really a big deal, but this is something people have really talked about a lot. I've seen a lot of people completely turn on Ronaldo because of this. So, I mean, obviously people think a lot more of it than I do.
I think, and this is not really in my nature to kind of believe these conspiracies, I feel like there is some bad blood somewhere. Because, I mean, like, forget the stuff that Ronaldo said about the family and stuff. And by the way, Real Madrid players have been kind of saying the same thing. Like, we're a big family this year, blah, blah, blah. Asensio has said it. Ramos has said it. Again, I don't want to read too much into that stuff. Players will say how they feel, and sometimes we read too much into it. This thing about not showing up, to me, and again, just a conspiracy on my end, but just a sense I have, was a bit of pettiness involved. Because everything, the way the stories have been told, the way it's been reported, the official statements we have from, like, real statements, to me, it doesn't add up. Because on one hand, Ronaldo was on his way. There were a dozen seats reserved for him and his entourage, as Gavin Marcotti reported. And they got word of a source leaked to them that he was not going to win and Modric was going to win. And then, according to Marcotti, they call Juve, and they don't even call UEFA directly, they call Juve and say, this is a situation, and, you know, we just kind of, for a personal decision, we don't want to go anymore. And then Juve calls UEFA and says, none of us are going to show up. And Juve officials, by the way, were just outside the place. Like, they were there. They were not even on the plane. They were already there. Then they all decided not to go collectively. And then later on, the Juve CEO, Marcotta, says basically that it's shameful that Ronaldo didn't win. Allegri also says, we were very disappointed at this decision. Mendes' comments, his sister posted a graphic on Instagram shortly after comparing Ronaldo and Modric's stats and saying that it's a disgrace. So all of that...
She deleted it afterwards, right?
So, yeah, but still, like, it's... I mean, she said it. Like, it's, I think, this is not in my nature to kind of be going through these conspiracies. I'm the one who's trying to just calm people down and say, like, it's just nothing, just it's in your head. This to me feels like a little more, I don't know. I could be wrong. I really could be. I don't know. But I really feel like if he didn't get this news, I think he would be sitting there.
I think that's very possible. I mean, I'm not denying. I think he didn't go because he knew the news. Like, to me, that necessarily bothered me. But I think you make some valid points with, like, all of the comments kind of adding up. But, I mean, should you really let this sully what Aldo did with us? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like a year later, like, we're not going to care as much. It's just in the moment, this is very emotional. Modric has been a fan favorite. Like, he's one of the few players that I don't think... Madridistas are largely not allowed to criticize. He's beloved. We felt he's been underappreciated, and that this is, like, as much as it is an award for his achievements from last season and last year, it's an award for, like, all he's done across his career, and we're very protective of that. But I think also we always kind of knew Ronaldo was like this, that he was this obsessed with being the best and winning all the personal awards.
Which,
and
by the way, is what makes him so great. Like, that's it's like, not necessarily a bad thing, you know. It's just
right. Like, this is not like a new revelation. Like, he gets upset when he doesn't win, and it motivates him to go out and be better next time. That this is who he's always been.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if then, like, if this is who he's always been, if he's always known that, I don't know if this can necessarily, like, does it make sense to change your assessment of Aldo because of this? I don't know. Like, he's always much about these things, and he's just psychotically obsessed. He is like a Michael Jordan type figure who's just obsessed with being the best. And he's with a new team now. Like, he has new teammates. I mean, this probably would have been more of an issue if he was Real Madrid and this didn't happen, but I don't know how much I want to dwell on this because, like you said, Keon, there maybe is something to this. Then also we might be reading too much into it. Like, I mean, I don't know. Like, this is something that I just kind of want to move on from. I don't see, sure. I don't see the point, like, dwelling on it unless you want to get angry about it, which I guess you can, but I think a month from now, most of us would have forgotten what happened.
Yeah, I think so. Before I let you go, please plug away. Tell us about your Cohen Trout video.
Right. So this is something that has just kind of like happened, and we haven't really discussed it, is that Real Madrid finally released Cohen Trout from his contract, and he's gone back to Rio Ave, his boyhood club in Portugal, where he became he came up and showed everyone that, like, he was a top class young talent, and like Benfica and other clubs, like, started looking into him. I thought that we should appreciate what he did for the club, because I think in his prime, in from 2012 to 2014, he was one of the very best left backs in the world, and there were periods when we thought that he was better than Marcelo. He was more balanced. He provided us better defensive stability, and that's not easy because Marcelo has been a top-class left-back for a very long time, even at that time. And in particular, the performances that stood out were the over the two legs against Bayern Munich in 2014 in a semi-final, took us to our first final in 12 years, and Cohen Trout put in two of the best defensive performances I've ever seen. Completely locked down Arty and Robin, you know, just for one game, for two. And I don't know how many other players in world football can say they did that. Just made a video just analyzing his performance on that. You can check that out on the site. It's in the link sets at the bottom of every article. It's on my YouTube channel as well. It's on our Facebook page. Just check it out. You know, if whether you watched Real Madrid at the time or you didn't, this guy, he was one of the better left backs in the world at the time, and I think it's important that we appreciate what he contributed to us.
It was nice to go down that memory lane, because Cohen Trout, like, in his day, he was great, like, as a two-way wing back. And I think one of the most underrated things, we always used to have this stereotype in our head that Cohen Trout was a defensive fullback, Marcelo offensive, but Cohen Trout, like, it's interesting when you watched him for Portugal during that era, he was actually very good offensively, and maybe Mourinho didn't want him to attack as much, I don't know, but he was capable. I, you know, in his peak, he was quite an enjoyable fullback and someone you'd go to war with, because, you know, he really fought with the pitch, had some epic duels with Messi. I guess that went up Friday, right? Friday was a big day for us, because Friday you posted that video. And then I posted a big column, kind of just, I was waiting for the squad to get finalized before I wrote this piece, so that I wanted it to be finalized going in, knowing exactly what we're you know, going in with. So I wrote a big column on Friday, so go back and check those pieces both out. What's it, Sunday night, tonight? By the time you listen to this podcast, maybe might be Monday morning, C-Trick should have a tactical review of the Leganes game up. And Sam Sharp and Matt Wilson and I will be back Tuesday to talk about the low knees. Diego and I, Chudos Tacticus, tomorrow. And I know there'll be more columns this week, more stuff. International break, I think we have a couple weeks off. So,
oh, the great, lovely international break.
So I guess we'll have to just, I don't know, make do with doing mailbags, and maybe you can do some more some more nostalgic content. And I guess the last thing to do is just do Patreon shoutouts. So again, patreon.com/managingmadrid is where you go to pledge one of your awards. If you pledge $10 or more, you get a specific shout out on this podcast. So shout out to Sergio Monleon, Tyler Dixon, Raul Gutierrez, Gary Kohud, Nick DeStefane, Raghav Potluri, Bjorn Salvador, Dan Berthy, John Fernandez, Frederick Sundros, Selvin Adolfo Chamali Perez, Anas Alazawi, Sheikh Atiri, Red Bat, Leon Stavronakis, Armin Dashi, Eric Rogers, Nick Ribeiro, Yahya Ibrahim, Said Mahad, Vicky Cohen, Magnus Lext, Jason Fitz, Anton Hackbert, Solomon Ortiz, Jeanette, Jimmy Obeid, and Daniel Smith. Thank you so much to everybody. You guys are amazing. Thank you for supporting the show. You guys, just fantastic. Warms our heart every week to read those names. Omarvin, thank you so much. And Hala Madrid.
Hala Madrid.